This is frequency 154725 on your scanner dials, pirate scum. Welcome, post-Trump ne'er-do-wells, to this, episode 17 of Gateway Geeks. This time we embrace the desert of the real. We consider the latest slew of mutant uprisings and the great Twitter war of 2017. Who hacked Putin's English language Twitter? Did he really call President Trump low energy? Don't forget to water those precious few houseplants with Brondo. It's what plants crave, and it's got electrolytes. And now your hosts, Joe and Aaron.
Okay, welcome to Gateway Geeks podcast, episode 17, possibly the last episode, which is what we're going to be saying about every episode for the next 4 years.
This is the November episode, and so you all know what we're going through.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, occasionally we would use this opportunity to talk about things we're thankful for. Yeah. But I got nothing.
I've got a couple. I'm thankful that we can look forward to 4 to 8 years of some spectacular artistic expression.
Assuming artists aren't all rounded up and thrown in the gulag.
I mean, we're going to...
Or deported, or shot by police, or, you know, whatever.
I'll be curious to see what new take on zombies will be in the age of Trump.
Yeah. I mean, the sort of class divide that's going to become even greater somehow. Mm-hmm. I predict vampires come back.
Yeah.
That would be my guess.
Vampires will come back.
Well, they'll all be like fat, doughy guys with gold toilets. Okay, so the first thing that we are in the news section just necessarily is going to be very long. We promise we aren't just going to spend the whole thing bitching about Trump.
Yeah.
Not directly.
Yeah.
We're going to try to keep this interesting for you. But the first thing that I want to talk about is something I've have been, and Aaron, I'm sure, has been also engaged in some serious like worrying about media literacy.
Mm-hmm.
In my classes, you know, I've noticed, I mean, even amongst graduate students, people really do have problems determining what is true and what is not true.
Yeah.
And frequently the step that they seem to be getting caught up on is actually looking it up.
Mm-hmm.
Like most people would rather just say whatever bullshit they heard, just repeat it,
right,
rather than taking 3 seconds. And, you know, inevitably, anytime you start talking about technology, some baby boomer in the audience will pull out their cell phone and be like, we have the cell phones now. We don't need, you know,
yeah,
like...
We don't need libraries. We don't need you silly, you know, people with your ideas of primary and secondary and sources. And...
Well, let me just use this opportunity to say, clearly you do.
Yeah.
Because if anything, this proves that libraries are more necessary than they've ever been,
yeah,
if only as fallout shelters.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, how many of us really take the time with every news article that we come across to actually say, well, hold on, let me take 2 seconds to check Snopes.
Well, speaking of Snopes, yeah. I mean, in the issue now is that so many of these articles we're seeing online are so outlandish sounding that it really is just like an arbitrary... I mean, the only difference between a Snopes... Like, if you look on Snopes, for those of you who don't know, Snopes is a website where you can go and you can type in a headline that you've seen somewhere, and there are people who are researching whether, right, or not it is accurate, and you can find the credentials of the researchers at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, some of you may have seen this article going around talking about how in Germany in the late 20s, when Hitler sort of got on the political scene, how people would say, oh, Hitler's anti-Semitism, his racism, it's just a populist ploy to get, you know, like the less educated people on his side. And he doesn't really mean it. It's just something he's doing. Mm-hmm. Well, turns out that is actually true, because I'm looking at Snopes right now.
Yeah.
So the researcher's name is Alex Kasprick, and the headline, which, let's see, was in 1922 in the New York Times. The headline is, New Popular Idol Rises in Bavaria. Hitler credited with extraordinary powers of swaying crowds to his will. Forum's gray-shirted army. Armed with blackjacks and revolvers, well-disciplined, they obey orders implicitly. Leaders are reactionary. Blah, blah, blah. But there's a line in this article where it actually does say, quote, or it does say Hitler was, quote, merely using anti-Semitic propaganda as a bait to catch masses of followers, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
That is a huge miscalculation by the New York Times, and I suspect not the last miscalculation by the media that we will be able to point to in the coming years when we're all living in storage lockers.
Yeah.
So there's that. We'll leave it at that. In terms of other kind of media literacy sort of stuff, a couple of these kind of the big Silicon Valley, you know, muckety mucks have come out and decided that they're going to attempt to kind of put the kibosh on some of this fake news that comes out. Mark Zuckerberg among them, and
And Google execs, mm-hmm. yeah. But yeah, and good luck. I wish them the best of luck with that. I mean, one of the takeaways, and I know if you're listening to this, you've already read this or heard this, but you know, one of the big takeaways from this election was how reinforced each of our bubbles has become, mm-hmm. to the point where journalists were like, "Oh, right, there are other Americans out there that
and Nate Silver's thing was so incredibly off. Did we talk? I guess our last podcast was in October, so we couldn't have talked about this already. But for those of you who didn't see Nate Silver, the night of the election, Nate Silver was giving Hillary 7-3 odds mm-hmm. against Trump. You know, you all know how that turned out.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, when you know someone's giving odds, that it is implied in those odds that yes, there is a chance that I will be wrong or that the other person will win, and that chance is contained within my prediction. But none of his other predictions really came to pass. And for those of you who don't know, Nate Silver is kind of well known for predicting Obama's win. And that's like the cachet that he's been, riding on for the last.
that was the...
Until now.
Yeah. You know, now he has to earn his keep again.
Yeah. Or, you know, just move to Canada is what he should do. But so anyway, getting back to this media literacy thing, Mark Zuckerberg was actually confronted with this sort of idea that the fake news is one of the things that caused the election to go Trump's way. And one of the things he said was that the notion that fake news influenced the U.S. presidential election, he called it a pretty crazy idea, showing that Mark Zuckerberg is yet another clueless white person, clueless rich white person. Yeah. The worst kind. But so anyway, if there's this article on NPR that I found to be interesting, where it basically he just goes into talking about, you know, how it can't be the fake news that's influencing people's decisions because people are too smart for that, and you know, ultimately the truth will win out. And he's basically couching his complacency in these very ideological terms. It's a pretty typical Silicon Valley bait and switch kind of thing, where it's like a minute ago we were talking about how this is your fault and now we're talking about ideals. Mm-hmm. How about you just fix the shit you broke and then we'll have our own ideals. I mean, that's kind of I don't know, I don't think it's a secret, I've never really been that impressed with Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, so anyway, moving on from that, we talked a little bit about the Nintendo Switch already, which is just something that I think warrants news briefly. So it actually looks pretty cool. It doesn't require a persistent internet connection. It's the whole console itself is mobile and it has a screen that you can carry with it. Uh-huh. So when you're in that RV, fleeing the nuclear fallout in the major cities, you could play this for a while until you run out of gasoline.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
what I look forward to whenever Nintendo puts something forward, you know, try something new, isn't, oh boy, I want to get that new Nintendo thing, is, oh boy, I can't wait to see what Microsoft and Sony managed to do, with mm-hmm. with this new tool, that they can.
Well, see, that's what's so interesting to me is, you know, people will act as though like Apple is this huge innovator, when really, I mean, companies like Nintendo, like these scrappy little companies who take it upon themselves to come up with new ideas, which then immediately get copied. I mean, if you look at the PlayStation, was it called Play? What were the little, where they looked like microphones, but they were motion detector.
Oh, I don't remember, but I know what you're talking
those
about.
Those were totally just, those were Wiimotes.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Yeah, and now from what I've seen, we're just, another tool for the VR rigs.
Uh-huh, yeah, yeah. I mean, what PlayStation added to those was the light part basically indicates through the VR camera like where in the room you are, mm-hmm. And when you're using something like the Vive, the two handheld controllers are located by the cameras mm-hmm. that you have to hang up somewhere or put on a table somewhere. Sure. But anyway, you can do simultaneous co-op with this new with Nintendo Switch. It looks really cool. I mean, I would check it out. I would give it a little while to see what they do. There's a game that the new Zelda Breath of the Wild is coming out, but it's also coming out on Wii U. Mm-hmm. So if you have a Wii U, you might want to just wait and just get it on that, and then it's totally up to you. But they're doing they're putting out Skyrim on it and Splatoon, and there's gonna be a new Mario game, new Mario Kart, of course.
Yeah.
But that's cool. That gave me some amount of hope.
And along the lines of technological advancements and the consequences thereof, one of the things that's kind of been on my mind this month has been the Senate a la carte entertainment and the application of paywalls to those tools. Mm-hmm. And I was reading an article it was either IO9 or Gizmodo.
I think it's IO9. I have it right here.
Where they're talking about, it's talking about how CBS's justification for airing its upcoming Star Trek series exclusively on their, almost exclusively on their pay-per-view, or not pay-per-view, their paid streaming service.
There's behind the paywall. The title of this article is, despite current glut of successful sci-fi shows, CBS executive says new Star Trek wouldn't work on TV.
Yeah.
The first line is, CBS can eat a bag of dicks.
Yeah. We're in a renaissance of science fiction shows right now. I mean, the sci-fi network, oddly enough, is actually showing science fiction based programming. You have huge amounts of sci-fi programming on Netflix, on mm-hmm. Hulu, on. Mm-hmm.
What I find to be really interesting about this, right, is so you had cable stations for a while that were ostensibly formed for a particular purpose. Mm-hmm. You had the History Channel, you had the Sci-Fi Channel, you had Cartoon Network, things like that. Should show cartoons, sci-fi, history, respectively.
Yeah.
But then you had this reality TV thing where all of them got flooded with some shitty reality. Like, all of them had something like that.
Right, yeah. It was all, let's have really inexpensive to produce programming that we can just churn out and also promotes the purchase of some additional product, like VH1 type top 10 things. Like, you know, by the way, you know, if you liked our top 10 list, you can go out and buy
whatever nonsense.
Right.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I mean, I never, like, History Channel is an example. I used to really watch it all the time, not because I liked their weird conservative bent of like warmongering History Channel stuff, but because 70% of the stuff on the channel used to actually be like interesting to watch. Even if you knew it was bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, like Hitler was like the secret occult, like Nazi, like where they found the Spear of Death, like bullshit like that.
Right. I mean, History Channel, you know, once upon a time, it went from history to, history with an asterisk saying, you know, okay, this, we've taken this one book that this one person wrote and we're going to.
The pyramids are spaceships.
Exactly.
aliens.
Yes. And then to the point where it was basically aliens, Hitler, aliens, and CGI battles.
Well, you know what's really interesting now, and I can't remember, do you remember if it's Discovery Channel? I think it's National Geographic got bought by Rupert Murdoch's parent company.
Yep.
That is a nightmare, because now if you go on, I was watching Discovery Channel last time I was in the doctor's office, and they had this show, and I haven't had cable TV for like 6 or 7 years, so I'm sure I'm missing out on a lot of this, but they had this show where these guys went around with this ground-penetrating radar. Mm-hmm. And this is something that field archaeologists do quite frequently. They do something first where they do what's called a surface survey, mm-hmm. where they walk along the top of an area and they'll look and see what they can find. And like if they find pottery shards, like if they find, let's say, 15 pottery shards in 2 square miles, I don't know enough about archaeology to know what that ratio needs to be. They'll say, okay, well, we can extrapolate based on what we found here that there's going to be this many more things. There could be this many more things below the surface. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we can justify bringing in students, bringing in people with doctorates to do an excavation. Mm-hmm. So the ground penetrating radar is like step two of that process where they roll it over the same area and they say, okay, we can look down and we can tell that the density in this area is much greater than it should be if it were just like dirt or rocks or something. Yeah. Or, you know, the density is much less, or there's a weird combination of elements here, something. So they have this show where the whole thing, the whole premise is that, and then they reconstruct, like, using these weird sort of CAD schematics of buildings. They reconstruct, like, what part of an ancient building in, you know, like Rome or something looks like beneath the surface. And then the whole show is just them talking. And it's like a reality show because they go in and they talk to like people who work at that building who are historians. And then at the end, they reveal whatever this ground penetrating radar laser schematic thing, whatever those reveal. Yeah. It's the big reveal like in reality TV.
Sure.
And that would, to me, like that would be interesting if it were part of a documentary.
Uh-huh.
And it were like some great, you know, like if they were doing that in, you know, the Valley of the Kings or something.
Sure.
But they're just doing it in like random plaza in southern Italy.
Yeah. Well a lot of networks, you know, you get that new toy and they're like, hey, let's yeah, I mean,
run this into the ground.
Like, was it? I don't know if it was CNN, but like one of those networks got like drones one time, and all of a sudden, let's have drones all the time.
Right, where they're like flying drones into volcanoes.
Yeah,
like or where they fly them over volcanoes, and yeah, and I mean, this my whole point for bringing this up. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to sidetrack this. My whole point for bringing this up is you start off and you have like a relatively interesting documentary about, I don't know, Vlad the Impaler.
Yeah,
sure, it's not high scholarship. It's pop scholarship.
Yeah,
it's whatever.
Yeah.
But it contains within it real historical insights, real information. They interview real experts. I saw a really good one on Channel 9 that had Dr. Cosmopolis from UMSL, who I took classes with, who's like he's I think an expert in like Bronze Age Greek archaeology and culture and all that. They had him on it, and that was great. But then you have shows like that, and then it moves down to like, then we're going to do all the shticky ground penetrating radar. We're going to do like, you know, an archaeology dig, except it's actually a reality show because we're going to interview everyone about how they feel sleeping in tents out in the middle of the desert, kind of thing.
And that brings us back around to what's going on with a lot of entertainment outlets. Like,
yeah.
I mean, what you're describing reminds me a lot of what happened with Tech TV and G4.
Yeah,
you had this one network, Tech TV, that was a niche channel for a niche audience. They didn't have necessarily the highest production values, but they had programming that was meaningful and interesting and helpful to, you know, a lot of people.
Yeah.
Then it got bought up by G4, and it became kind of like what you're describing, this kind of overproduced, glitzy, pretty to look at, but kind of hollow.
Well, and this is the thing that I think we should learn from this election in general. People, media elites, mm-hmm. i.e., producers, actors, you know, whatever, like anyone involved in Hollywood intimately, mm-hmm. anyone who makes more than $100,000 a year mm-hmm. in the entertainment industry,
yeah.
these people do not understand what it's like to be a regular person.
Yeah.
And so one of the problems when they, it's where you're talking about things being overproduced,
mm-hmm.
they're ruining entertainment because they're trying to make it conform to a worldview they have that is simultaneously cynical uh-huh. and detached from reality.
Yeah.
So what Alec Baldwin uh-huh. thinks the American people want has no relationship to what the American people actually want, because Alec Baldwin doesn't talk to regular people.
Yeah.
He's not getting this information. There's no way for him to get this information unless he were to actually go out and do like Pew Research study. Alec Baldwin is not looking at Pew Research study results. And I think what that leads to is the people who may sort of have good intentions for the American public in the entertainment industry end up sort of getting sidelined by people like the guys on Pawn Star who sort of understand. Yeah. Maybe they're a little closer to what regular people want. And then they sail in, they get a little bit popular, and then they just run it into the ground and make as much money as they can out of it.
Yeah. That's kind of along the lines of one of the fears that those of us who are fans of Geek and Sundry and the Nerdist have. They're themselves, but they're like, they have this partnership they're calling Alpha, where it's a subscription-based type thing where you get exclusive entertainment, and a lot of the stuff that's underneath the umbrella of Geek and Sundry, like Tabletop and Critical Role and other programs, thankfully some of the programming is untouched. But like Tabletop, the new season has begun, and the first two episodes are free and immediately available. But if you want to continue to watch the new episodes immediately, you have to join up with this alpha thing.
Right.
And eventually the episodes will become available to everyone. So it's not a deal breaker.
Sure. But, well, which is good. I mean, that's what's interesting is you have these companies. I mean, like, you can trust capitalism to do a couple things. One of the main things you can trust capitalism to do is to treat anything, any commodity, as the drug dealer is mm-hmm. the quintessential capitalist. So whenever, like, YouTube is a good example. Mm-hmm. YouTube started out as a sort of very low budget, like Radio Shack community way of producing your own content mm-hmm. and sharing it with other people who also produce their own content. Now you have YouTube Red, which mm-hmm. Aaron and I have talked about, which sounds too much like RedTube.
Yeah.
This is why you need to have regular people in the room when you make these decisions.
Yes. Yeah.
If you don't know what RedTube is, don't Google it.
Yeah.
But don't Google it at work. But so you have the first few hits are free.
Yeah.
And then after a while, they're going to say, okay, well, there's this higher tier mm-hmm. that if you really want to get the good stuff, this is like the premium, you know, yeah. quote, content.
Yeah.
And then when you look at the shows that they're producing for YouTube Red, it's like PewDiePie gets scared. It looks like total yeah. horseshit.
Oh, yeah.
It's just...
yeah. And that's kind of... not only that, but you also have the worry that once this gets normalized, that you know, that there's that expectation that you know to get what you want, you have to pay that extra thing. A number of things that concern me with that. One, if the corporation that's running that's holding the master switch, great book by Tim Wu,
yes,
which is all about what we're talking about. The corporation might say, okay, John Smith, you're a great host. You bring on a lot of people, but our advertisers don't really like that you have that kind of that rainbow goatee. So, you know, we'd really like you to shave that off. Because that way we can, there's that concern, and the other concern just is I love all of a la carte entertainment. However, there are only so many $6 or $10 a month subscriptions.
Yes.
That one person can have.
Right. I mean, like Tracy and I have Netflix. We have a few subscriptions. We have a subscription to a MMO that we play. But, you know, we don't have like Hulu and 50 other things yeah. because it's like, okay, well, now you're approaching the price of just getting cable.
Yeah.
You know, at some point. So, I mean,
And Time Warner and Comcast know this, which is why they're like, okay, you don't want cable? That's fine. We'll provide you with the same entertainment a la carte for this amount. So you're paying the same price anyway.
But the thing about that, though, is those companies are not the companies that are making most of the a la carte stuff. I mean, aside from HBO Go
yeah.
or things like that. I mean, you do have, like, I think all of the premium movie channels probably have something like that, and I think like AMC, any channel that has a really well-known show,
uh-huh.
AMC is what has Walking Dead, right?
Yeah.
So like AMC has one. I mean, but the thing is that at some point you're going to reach a saturation. Also, there's only so many things a person can watch.
Mm-hmm.
So you could. I mean, like, I like Game of Thrones. I like The Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. I like all of these super popular shows that everyone watches.
Sure.
But I don't watch them all because I know, like with Game of Thrones, I'll just wait till the show comes out
yeah.
and I'll buy a whole season of it for $60 yeah. and that's like six
or,
months.
Or just go to your library.
Or yeah. just check them out. Yeah. 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 I mean,
yeah. So the punchline for me at least yeah. is just I really hope that somebody taps the brake. You know, I know that I'm not going to ask them to stop because that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But just tap the brake and say, you know, get a check the pulse and say, what can we do? Because
right.
I mean, you know, we're not CBS and CBS/Paramount already kind of pooped the bed this year with the Star Trek anniversary. You know,
I think it's actually almost more obscene that you said poop instead of shit there.
I am. I have a quest. I'm going to try to maintain some level.
Aaron's tried to bring this down to a T rating instead of an M rating.
Yep.
Good luck with that, my friend.
We want your content. You want to give us your content. We're willing to pay a reasonable amount for your content.
Right.
But come on.
Well, and it's sort of like what's going on with the Marvel Universe right now. Yeah. So Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, mm-hmm. loved those, both of those.
Yeah.
Luke Cage is the only one I watched all the way through. Jessica Jones, after I watched, I mean like all the way through in one
okay.
series, I've gone back and like since finished it.
Gotcha.
But Luke Cage is the only one that I felt the compulsion to just sit down and just watch the whole thing like one giant long movie mm-hmm. because it was compelling. And let me put it this way. The cool thing about that I thought was really cool about Luke Cage was it was sort of set up not like a straight superhero TV show. So you had all the superhero elements happening.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that differentiated Luke Cage from like Daredevil is that Luke Cage had a particular like feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like it was happening in a specific place. The setting, clearly Harlem,
yeah.
felt like it was all happening in a real place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hell's Kitchen doesn't feel like a place to me. Like,
right.
I think what helped Luke Cage was that you had Harlem's Paradise as like this center nexus for all the plot devices.
Yeah.
And then at the beginning of every episode, you had that really awesome thing where they'd bring in like an actual well-known performer, musical performer,
yeah.
to sing in there. And I think, you know, if you're going to do something different, I say just run with it forever. But the problem is now Marvel has got, they're doing what? They're doing the Defenders and they're doing, and the thing is they...
Thankfully, I don't remember what the episode number is, but it's significantly... less than their previous, like Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage, because
yeah.
they realized that, as I understand it, they realized that each of these seasons of these shows are run just a little too long.
Well, and even Luke Cage goes on a little bit, but I mean, the woman's name I was trying to think of earlier was Sharon Jones from the Dap Kings. She's I've heard her called the like second coming of James Brown, and but the cool thing about it is like she sings a well known song. I think it's called 100 Days. It's like she's an amazing singer, but at the beginning of one of those episodes, she's singing. And if you take that kind of stuff out of the episode and it's just like blind superhero guy
mm-hmm.
fights Kingpin, Vincent D'Onofrio,
yeah.
over and over and over again, Vincent D'Onofrio flips a table. I mean, there's not enough content. Daredevil, the comic book, mm-hmm. was never meant to supply three seasons of a TV show.
Right.
It just wasn't. There's just not enough. And I think Marvel needs to... They're trying to bring some of these threads together with things like the Defenders, where mm-hmm. they're going to have all these different superheroes. But I just feel like it's the same thing we're talking about, where producers are just... Everything they find that works, they want to just wring every last drop of money out of that,
mm-hmm.
blood out of that stone,
yeah.
and then just like leave it there,
yeah.
you know, no, desiccated on the ground. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of what that's one of the problems I had with Fox's X-Men movies,
yeah.
Was there are only like a handful of really cinematic, really entertaining X-Men stories that's going to put a sizable amount of people's butts in the seats of theaters.
Yeah.
And they've told those stories now.
Well, right.
Yeah, and what they can, all they have room to do, the things that they have room to do now, retell those stories
yep.
in a different way, because I mean, Dark Phoenix Saga is interesting.
And they're going to retell that again after this one.
Right. You could do, or try to tell truly original stories with these characters, which they're not going to do because, you know, they want to placate the us nerds
right.
who need repetition, because that's comfortable to us. Or three, go, you know, take the risk of telling the really ridiculous X-Men stories, like the aliens, like the Shi'ar and the Brood, and
yeah, and well, and the thing is, there are actually a lot of X-Men stories that are sort of like the lesser known ones, mm-hmm. where it's like one kind of shitty, lame villain comes in,
yeah.
and then it's really just about a conflict between that villain and like one of the X-Men, and then the other X-Men help defeat that villain,
yeah.
and you can't make that into a movie. That would be a good TV TV show.
And some of the more interesting,
like Morph, but his power is basically just that he can like make his face look like whoever.
Personally, I would love a long shot in Mojo's universe.
Yeah.
But we're not, but I don't see that happening because that's a CGI nightmare.
Well, and X-Men, you know, there are a couple Marvel properties that are very reactionary to DC innovations. Like they're just, they basically just, anytime DC tried something, they would also try it in whatever this franchise, and X-Men is one of those. So sometimes you'll see these villains that don't really make sense for the X-Men to be fighting. But anyway, I mean, I think, like we've talked about before, the cool thing about X-Men is that it's like an inclusive kind of postmodern opportunity there to just give place on the stage to a bunch of different kinds of people and not just have two or three white people,
sure,
and one or two people of color or something. I mean, like, you can actually have a group of people,
yeah,
who make sense together, and it's not just like there's one token person in there.
Yeah. So you and I earlier today we were talking about some comic book movies, and like, I think it was Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
And I was reminded again of, you know, how lucky is it that we live in a time where we can have these conversations of both Marvel and Fox's Marvel titles have gotten to the,
yeah,
point where they're formulaic, and because we have this, because we're in a time of geeky joy where we have live action anime movies being produced.
Right. That said, yeah, as someone who, I mean, I'm by no means an expert on anime, but yeah, I do like anime. So, you know, on the one hand, you've got, okay, for those of you who haven't seen this, there are a couple live action Dragon Ball Z movies that are terrible. I saw
scenes of the
Goku one. Goku is an American white guy.
Yeah.
So it's why?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then the new Ghost in the Shell has Scarlett Johansson, of course, who as the Major.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. Scarlett Johansson is already, Aaron and I have talked about this, she's already the lead female character in the Marvel Universe right now.
Uh-huh.
If you don't count Jessica Jones,
right,
I would challenge you to name another major character in the Disney Marvel Universe,
yeah,
right now who is female.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say, like, what's the one woman from Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you're not going to find someone on the level of Black Widow, who even in the original intent of, you know, the comic books was not like a main major character.
Yeah. We'll see what happens when they introduce Captain Marvel and
right. That would, yeah, if, yeah, yeah. But I mean, the thing, what I'm saying is, why would you? I can understand these producers, again, who we can sort of just, they can be like the bugaboos for everything we want to say is wrong with Hollywood.
Well, in previous episodes, I've voiced my dislike for Max Landis. He has a persona or a demeanor that's just unwatchable, in my opinion. However, however, I have to admit he has made thoughtful observations, and one of them, when the topic of ScarJo in Ghost in the Shell is, unfortunately, the way that Hollywood exists right now, a major studio isn't going to greenlight a big movie unless they can hedge their bet and say, you know, having her name and her face on a movie poster is going to guarantee us X amount of money.
Right. And you know what's really weird about that is I almost think they would do better, mm-hmm, if they just recorded it with Japanese actors in Japanese, mm-hmm, and then just had subtitles.
Yeah.
I almost feel like you could get, it would be like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah.
Like, people would go see that. I mean, it's been proven that people would go see it, you know, like every, you know, like here, like there are all kinds of really major, particularly, I mean, Ghost in a Shell is not a martial arts movie. It's right. It'll be an action movie.
Yeah.
But I just don't like this whitewashing. And I know that people will say, oh, like identity politics, that's what caused Donald Trump to get elected, yeah, and blah, 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 blah. It's like, no. you can say what you want about identity politics, but when you are part of global culture,
mm-hmm,
you know, Japanese culture, American culture, both parts of global culture, it makes more sense to maintain some seed of the original, like, national cultural identity of a character within a particular property, because otherwise it becomes this bland vanilla whiteness, mm-hmm. that no one cares about that is boring. I mean, and that's what we're talking about. Like, that's one of the things that producers do. And it's kind of like if Scarlett Johansson is the female protagonist in every freaking post-apocalyptic sci-fi movie.
Right. And if X-Men Apocalypse is any indication, we can look forward to Jennifer Lawrence not being, you know, the second choice, because I predict she's going to be like, no, I'm done with...
She looks so bored in those movies. You were absolutely right about that. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, to me, it's not so much like, okay, this was made by, this was based on an Asian property, therefore you have to have Asian actors in it. Yeah. I don't think it's that simple.
Yeah.
What I do think, though, is that you need to reflect the cultural context of from which the art came.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that with someone who is like the poster woman for American cinema. Like, it just doesn't make sense.
Right.
You're trying to just cherry pick parts of culture without paying them their due deference yeah. within production. So that's my problem. I'm still going to go see it.
The trailers are impressive. Speaking of trailers, I mean, the latest trailer of Ghost in the Shell is out and it's beautiful. There's a new trailer for
Full Metal Alchemist,
which
is another live action.
Yeah, although that's just a super teaser of a
yeah.
thing.
It looks like they're actually gonna. It looks like they actually realize that there are Asian actors though, so that's awesome.
Yep,
that's something.
There's a sequel to the live action version of Death Note.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm really impressed by, or what I'm looking forward to, is that it's an actual sequel to the and not just a remake of the previous live action version.
Yeah, and that's something Aaron and I were talking. Like I recently bought the complete run of the anime, and I've read some of the manga. But when you're going through it, it very much is like a 1950s Superman kind of thing, where each time, like Aaron was saying, every like five episodes, Light realizes that now instead of just writing the name of the person who I want to kill in this book, I can write like the time of their death in the future and then have an alibi so no one will think it's me.
Right. They keep adding rules for to accommodate the story versus what I thought was just a beautifully elegantly simple set of a handful of rules.
Yeah. And a very common, I think I talked about this a little bit in our last podcast, but a very common premise of Japanese popular culture in terms of like drama and action and, you know, kind of shonen sort of stuff, which I'm pretty sure Death Note came out of Shonen Jump. I'm not sure. Not totally positive about that. But
it's got that feel to
that
it.
That feel to it, yeah.
Where it's edgy, not edgy.
So Shonen just means that it's for boys. That's what it means. But it's also kind of like pulpy teenager sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's enough happening with just the basic plot points that you don't need to continue to make this like a leveling up sort of RPG thing every couple of episodes.
Now I can do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Just
now I can kill mice from 400 feet with and now he's like tearing out notebook pages and making other people touch them because then they can see the Shinigami and
it's still entertaining, but it's one of those where it's like, couldn't you just keep it simple?
I mean, the thing I will say that I like about as a motif in a lot of anime is this like timeless meditative sort of, and I don't mean meditative in like Zen Buddhism. I'm assuming it's meditative because it's Japanese. Mm-hmm. What I mean is there's a contemplative element. So where if you watch American media, like if you watch, let's just compare it to something like Criminal Minds, which is a TV show that Tracy watches all the time, which is like a crime show. It's a police procedural, basically. There are elements of that in Death Note, but in Death Note, a lot of what you're seeing is you're seeing people contemplating their own actions, thinking about what the repercussions of their actions, of other people's actions, will be. In Death Note, there's a lot of talk about, like, you know, Light thinking, should I play God? Should I be choosing who dies? And then kind of switching into this weird, like, I am death incarnate kind of thing. But there aren't those same pauses for contemplation in a lot of American media, because in those pauses they'll insert, you know, like really loud music.
Uh-huh.
They'll insert like sex scenes. Yeah. They'll insert things that are spectacles that will distract you from actually contemplating what is really happening. It's more just get on, you know, get on. It's a small world. We'll go through the thing, and then you get off, and that's
Yeah.
That's the experience is canned and you don't have any opportunity to participate in the experience through actually considering what's happening. So there's that. And then let's see, what else? Rat Queens is relaunching March 2017 with a new issue one. Rat Queens is awesome. Yeah. You should check it out.
It is really, really good.
I don't know what happened with the last version. Do you know what happened?
Well, I
mean, it was good. It's just, yeah. I think like someone got sick or died or something.
Well, I remember correctly, the very first artist had some sort of legal trouble that led them to have to leave the comic. Definitely read Rock Queens if you can. It's so good.
Oh yeah, you're right. He had Rock Upchurch had a domestic violence arrest in 2014. Jesus Christ. Wow, glad he's gone.
Real quick on Rock Queens. One of the things that I really appreciate about the world that we live in is that artist's work was discovered on DeviantArt.com.
Uh-huh.
And we live in that. I love that we live in that world versus a time where you'd have to constantly submit. Well, I'm sure I still have to do this, your only avenue was to constantly submit to Marvel.
You do have multiple avenues. Well, and it's also kind of like what happens in music right now, where you're going to have a lot fewer U2s, Led Zeppelins, Guns N' Roses, kind of like giant bands that travel over the place. But you probably have a lot more people who are able to make some amount of money instead of just, it's not that I have to just tour constantly. People can hear my music online. I mean, this has been true since like MySpace. I'm not telling you guys anything new, but you're right. It does give you a few more options. Then you have crowdfunding and all of that too.
Yeah.
I think we should skip into actually talking about dystopia, 'cause we're like 50 minutes into this podcast.
Right. All right.
What do you say, Aaron?
let's make that happen. So,
so we're talking about dystopia, for, I think, obvious reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a topic that's going to be coming up a lot in the next 4 to 8 years.
Yeah, 4 years, please, yeah. 4 years. See, this is really the problem with our need as or our respective needs to feel that we are in some form of equilibrium. I think that's a very common human need, that you need to feel like whatever, like there's nothing new under the sun, which is something that can be very discouraging when you're creating.
Yeah.
But when you are, which is, I think, one of the reasons why times like this produce really good art, because it's quite clear that this is something new under the sun.
Yeah.
At least it's new since 1939 or 1929.
Yeah. Yes, things are bad, but trying to keep the glass half full, pretty exciting.
Jesus.
I
know what you're saying.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying.
I use the word exciting not in yay, this is a good thing. You know, it's more along the lines of
like I'm being chased by a T-Rex excited.
Yeah, exactly. It's like this is new. God. And this is going to
be. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when Thomas More originally came up with the idea of utopia, when he sort of codified it in a work by that same name, he was talking about, this was in the mid 16th century, so this was like, I'm trying to remember the exact year, I think it was like 1530 something when he wrote this, but he's talking about a world in which all things function copacetically, in which there's no striving to be anywhere else. You're in the best of all possible worlds. And there are a lot of philosophers who would say that we live in the best of all possible worlds. Mm-hmm. Right now, I don't know how much cachet any of those philosophers would have, unless you're a white supremacist, but I'm just trying to get thrown in the gulag early. but, then of course the reaction to utopia is dystopia. And dystopia became much more popular as a term if you look on things like Artemis, which is a database where you can search literary terms. You'll see that about towards the end of World War I, mm-hmm. the term dystopia became much more popular, because you can see sort of a new Dark Ages come in. You can see ways in which human beings might arrive at a dystopia. I mean, I, I just feel like in a lot of ways, we as human beings are flattering ourselves that we can change any of this stuff. But what makes us human, what makes it impressive, what anytime you watch a movie where aliens come and visit us, one thing that always seems to come out of those movies is, oh, the human spirit.
Yeah.
Human spirit. Yeah. And, you know, it's quite possible that just, you know, they're just kind of impressed about how delusional we're able to be.
In these stories, there's always the, you know, yes, there are still a few knuckleheads who are going to grab their guns and bombs.
The movie Aaron and I just saw, where a bunch of guys decide to try to blow up an alien spaceship.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah. So Aaron and I were just talking about some of the, you know, like pop culture predictions of dystopia and what it'll be like. I would just want to say that I think people sometimes forget that pop culture is not a record of history. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I'll have students who will like write a paper, and the examples they'll use for that paper, like I had a student write a paper that was basically like, oh, the 1950s were the good old days, and my examples are going to be like Leave It to Beaver and, you know, John Wayne World War II movies and crap like that. Those are not examples of history. Yeah. Those are recollections of history filtered through a popular consciousness, filtered through an individual artistic vision. Mm-hmm. Those in no way sort of recommend what our future might be.
Right.
All those do is they give you an individual viewpoint that can be examined for clues about what people remember about history.
Mm-hmm.
But that's it.
Yeah.
That said, The Simpsons.
Yeah.
The Simpsons. The Simpsons, Idiocracy. Isn't that it's Mike Judd, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, who did Idiocracy.
Yeah.
Our nephew, Tracy and our nephew, was in Idiocracy. He was one of the babies who drank, what plants crave?
I forget.
Bondo or whatever.
Yeah.
He was in the movie because it was filmed in Austin.
That's funny.
Shout out to Ace. Yeah. This podcast is hard for me. Go ahead, Aaron.
Sorry. Yeah. So what's bizarre about these examples is just here you have three things that should be lighthearted comedies. Like Idiocracy was supposed to be just sort of like wouldn't it be silly if, you know, the least qualified, least educated, most bombastic bozos, you know, rule the world. That wouldn't that just be goofy?
And the funny thing about Idiocracy is that it's actually more hopeful than our present reality.
Yeah.
Because in Idiocracy, the moronic, know-nothing president is black. And in ours, he's a white supremacist. It's actually worse in reality than it is in Idiocracy.
Yeah, but I mean, it's weird when you have pop culture predicting the future. I mean, you know, whenever some big new technology comes out, becomes popular, there's always the this was seen in Star Trek, or this was
right, like
Jules Verne created this image,
right, exactly.
But now we have things like Back to the Future 2 predicting the Cubs winning and Biff becoming the
becoming president.
Yeah.
yeah. I mean, there's at some point, and I mean, I think maybe in future podcasts when Aaron and I have had more time to like digest what is happening in our world right now.
Yeah.
We'll be able to talk about like all of the like the circular firing squad of the left and the right, and just being this, you know, rebirth of the Nazis. And I mean, that's what alt-right are. They're Nazis. I mean, they are. That's like, I'm not even being facetious.
Yeah, no, I don't want to get on a rant, but I mean, yeah, I'm sure. I suspect you agree with me that the media is, unfortunately, either being deliberately cowardly or being strategic in that, you know, they don't want to just get attacked by calling neo-Nazis the alt-right.
Well,
by calling, you know.
Yeah. And see, here's my thing, and I think this is just going to betray my interest in postmodernism in general, but the media is still functioning on a modernist paradigm.
Uh-huh.
So on the one hand, you have the media saying, okay, we're still going to emulate like Walter Cronkite and these, we're still going to try to tell both sides of the story, while simultaneously the rest of the world runs off in this postmodern direction of individual narrative, exposed to reacting with national, international dialectic, produces some communal average of truth. Because everyone, it's sort of like the adversarial legal system, where you assume that if you have two lawyers arguing against each other, they'll get to the right decision because somehow Lady, you know, like blind Lady Truth will bestow the win upon the person who is most right, which we know that's not really what happens. And in that same way, postmodernism is very naive. But in a similar way, modernism is very naive because it assumes that you can have an objective standpoint when only one side or the other of these two oppositional views is even attempting to be objective. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's the thing that, that the media is missing. The conservative sort of, you know, establishment, I guess at this point, it's a conservative establishment in our country is not attempting to be objective. No. They are harnessing their extreme subjectivity in such a way that it becomes a dominant narrative by insisting upon it over and over and over again when you have people on the other side who are reasonable people who will, when presented with evidence that counteracts one of their views, pause for a moment to consider that evidence, at which point the conservative right can just steamroll them by just repeating the same bullshit over and over again until people think it's true. And I mean, like, that's you have that coupled with overconfidence amongst general, like, just the average person about how much they can, how well they can sift through media in general and find what's true and what's not true. And you have too many tools. People don't understand how to use these tools. They think they do. I mean, everyone thinks they know how to use MS Word, but go into MS Word and make like a form that you can send out to someone. If you can do that, I will be impressed. I guarantee you like 80% of you can't do that. Or you would have to research, figure out how to do it. So you have this overconfidence in your ability kind of coupled with your lack of actual ability. And then you have an arbitrary choosing of which tools you're going to bring to bear on a given solution. And then when you choose that tool, you're sort of reinforced to use that tool over and over and over again, Facebook. There's nothing to really challenge this landslide of shitty assumptions. And at some point you just, you're so locked into this, like you said, the filter bubble, you're so locked into this terrible, like impoverished worldview that you have no way out. And I mean, like, so let me just, sorry, Aaron. Let's skip ahead a little bit. So Aaron and I thought a little bit about some of our favorite tyrants. The five tyrants that we each picked a few tyrants that we would prefer over Donald Trump. Let's take turns. Aaron, do you want to go first?
All right. So so the MCP, the Master Control Program from the first Tron movie. I mean, okay, sure, he forced self-aware programs to fight in gladiatorial combat, but he was organized. He had a plan, you know.
And similarly, I chose the machines from the Matrix. I mean, you know, you're plugged into this battery thing, like you don't know what's happening to you. I mean, you live a normal 20th century pre-Trump life. Every day you go to work, you know, occasionally, like, you can even have your little underground pretend you know, like, illegal software trafficking thing like Neo had, and then you even have the opportunity to transcend and escape this imaginary veil. So there, that at least exists. That doesn't exist in our present reality. I mean, Agent Smith, I mean, like, in the Matrix, they say, you know, one of the premises was when the machines first tried to create this Matrix, this reality, they created a...
an Eden.
An Eden, a utopia, and no one bought it. Everyone rejected it on sort of a reptile brain level, and so they realized they had to actually insert suffering. So any suffering or shittiness that exists in the Matrix exists only because human beings demanded it in order to be placated, in order to feel comfortable. So machines, really better guys, better human beings than Trump.
I'm going to go with Morlocks from the original Time Machine. I mean, yeah, sure, they ate the Eloi, but I mean, before dinner time, you know, they were comfortable. They played. They had music and art. And
And for a similar reason, I would say Nero, because he could at least play an instrument, you know?
I'm going to go with Ming the Merciless. I mean, yes, he pitted various governing bodies against one another so that he could stay in power. But, I mean, look at the diversity you had.
I think Aaron and I are both kind of like about to cry all the time now. My other one was Joffrey Baratheon because he's dead.
There's that. All right, I'm going to go with Dr. Zaius from the Planet of the Apes world. I mean, he actively deceived his fellow apes into thinking that they were, you know, they were the ruling body for all times. But at the same time, he was at least educated enough to know that, hey, the crazy humans that came before us destroyed everything. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say Immortan Joe from the new Mad Max movie, because he was responsible for Furiosa. And I guarantee you, Furiosa is more empowered than any woman in the Trump administration will be.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you, no one is grabbing anything on Furiosa.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
what
yeah.
I'm saying.
Yeah. Oh man. So
and then I also had Napoleon, but that's Napoleon literally would be a better leader than Donald Trump.
Yeah.
That's not even
yeah.
that's yeah. not even like me being facetious.
There are so many different dictators and tyrants.
Tsar Nicholas II.
Yeah, I mean, General Zod.
Did you know that under Tsar Nicholas II, the Japanese beat the Russians in the Russo-Japanese War in the very end of the 19th century?
Ugh.
Yeah. So just okay. So
do we want to do consumer confessions?
Yeah. Aaron and I are after this. I think we're going to probably eat some cake.
Yeah.
And maybe just cry into some pillows for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds
good.
I
either that or probably log on to some online first person shooter and just blow stuff up.
Yeah. I anticipate that World War II games are going to become more popular.
Yeah.
You know, any game where you can kill Nazis, although it may soon become like, you know, the NSA may tag you if you play too many of those.
It's gonna be crazy. Yeah. So.
And we're just two white guys.
Yeah.
We're two like working class, yeah. middle class white guys.
Yeah.
We really have all of our fears are very philosophical.
Yeah.
Most likely, nothing is going to happen to us.
Right.
But there.
The trouble is the normalization, acceptance, and celebration of the uneducated in positions of leadership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, where you have environmental concern. We're also looking at the longer picture of, you know, if our leadership wrecks us in ways that we can't even fathom right
well,
now.
Well, and that's another really interesting thing right now. Aaron and I were talking a little bit about this. Just the rise of sort of authoritarian, autocratic, fascist governments around the world. I mean, you have Brexit, which is like a nationalist sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Marine Le Pen, who is Jean-Marie Le Pen's daughter in France and the head of the National Front, which is a sort of neo-fascist nationalist organization. And then you have, I mean, there's just all kind like a, what, who is the leader of South Korea? The person who, I think it's like the prime minister, is under like all these, this investigation for being incredibly corrupt. And right now there are like mass protests in the street for him to resign, which is funny because I'm sure he's less corrupt than Trump already.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, commodity confessions.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. It's really hard for me. I'm having
no. This is a rough time.
This is kind of catharsis.
So the first thing on my list is Joe and I recently went to see an advanced screening of a movie that at the time of this recording is out now, called The Arrival. Not to be confused with the. Oh, what's his name from Winning?
Charlie Sheen.
Not to be confused with the Charlie Sheen movie of the same name, but The Arrival, starring Amy Adams and
Hawkeye,
and the actor who plays Hawkeye in the Avengers, whatever his name is, it'll come to us later. But it's so good. Basically, well, if you're listening to this, you probably already have read the synopsis, but it's so good. The closest equivalent I can think of is the movie Contact, only not nearly as schmaltzy.
Right, and although I will say just aesthetically, it reminds me a lot of Alien.
Yeah.
Like, just when they entered the ship and everything. I mean,
it's one of the things I'm really enjoying in a lot of sci-fi productions is the plausibility, plausible sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with the asterisk of, okay, yes, plausible, but it's unlikely that, you know, giant squid.
they're not mind flayers. I was bummed.
Yeah.
We shouldn't give too much of it away, but it's absolutely worth seeing. When Aaron suggested it, I mean, like, I've come to trust Aaron's judgment about cinema generally. So when he first suggested it, I was like, okay. And I'm really glad I went to see it. It was an amazing movie.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I try to pay, there's this company whose name I don't recall who puts out free advanced screening tickets for big titles. The idea being movie reviewers need to have a actual audience.
This is how Aaron and I went to see Mad Max. We need to start going to those and just telling them we're press, because as far as they know, we are.
We can
show them our website.
the trick with this company, though, is they send out tickets for everything. So, like, you know, the last four Arrival, they send us out there, hey, act now if you want to go see Trolls. Yeah, and I'm just like, this is kind of one of those, like, Ransom of Red Chief kind of things. So, yeah. You know, it's like, you know, no, you need to pay me to go see Trolls.
Yeah, let's see. One of my commodity confessions is The Witcher 3. Uh-huh. I went back to it for Halloween, and right now I'm approaching the holidays, and you know, our household, I mean, we have enough money to like survive, but we do not have extra money really.
Yeah.
So The Witcher is awesome because I already owned it from what is it, like, almost 2 years old now?
Yeah,
it's pretty old.
Yeah.
But it's got like 100 hours worth of gameplay, tons of quests.
Uh-huh.
The story is actually really good. It reminds you, if you haven't ever played it, there are two expansions out for it right now. Mm-hmm. I haven't even made it into I haven't even bought the expansion yet, but it's got this really cool Eastern European sort of mythology going on. It's very like Brothers Grimm kind of meets Van Helsing Dracula kind of. It's really awesome, and the best part about it is just running around in the game. And it's even sort of like those old KOTOR games where they had Kazak. Is that what it was called? Pazak?
Pazak. Yeah, Pazak. I remember that game. I so miss KOTOR, the first KOTOR.
If they made a KOTOR 3, that would be, oh my god.
Well, I mean, you know, one could make the argument that the Mass Effect trilogy was KOTOR 3.
No lightsabers.
Huh?
There are no lightsabers.
Yeah. Well, they tried with the arm that.
You're right. Yeah. They did.
So I have two more things. One of the upshots of. One of the many upshots of working in a library is is moments of discovery. And one of the things that the branch that I work at right now has a CD or a DVD collection that has Flash Gordon, the original Battlestar Galactica movie, you know, the old 70s mm-hmm. one,
yeah.
The Last Starfighter, and David Lynch's Dune.
Oh, nice.
So I'm just happy that it's a 4-day weekend.
Yeah.
Because my productivity would be wrecked. The other thing that I this is more just a plug than anything, because I've completed these. I have company out of town this weekend, and I'm really hoping that I can convince my cousin to the game Life is Strange a shot or Inside. Both of these are short games that could be completed in a long afternoon, but they have moments of just jaw-dropping surprise.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like video games are one of the problems with open world that I sort of think mirrors. I'm bringing these together because we were talking about both of them.
Yeah.
Sort of mirrors the problem with reality television is that it's so inclusive of everything kind of happening that it doesn't have like a focused plot.
Yeah.
And I think we're getting away from a lot of video games like that in mainstream gaming,
mm-hmm.
but in indie gaming, they're kind of picking up the slack with these awesome games like you're talking. They sort of remind you of the old style adventure games, but it's so much richer of an experience. Even something like Alan Wake, which is the gameplay in that game is totally terrible, but it's it's like Lovecraftian. It's like Stephen King. It's like when you play it, you feel like you're at the you're staying at the Twin Peaks,
sure,
you know, David Lynch kind of hotel resort thing. And there's something that's actually ends up being a lot more satisfying with those sorts of games.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if I may have mentioned this in a previous episode, but like right now, unfortunately, it's doing that that slow release of like once a month they'll put out a new episode of the new Telltale Games Batman thing.
Yeah.
And I think the latest one comes out maybe today at the time of this recording, but
November 22nd.
Yeah. And it's I totally agree with everything you're saying. The only thing that I hope happens soon now that the choose your own adventure video games have become a proven commodity, what I'm really hoping is more games that that do not have what I kind of think of as the illusion of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, yes, you're given a choice between saving this person or saving that person, or being nice to this person or being mean to that person, but at the end your character is still going to end up close to the same place as he was or she was at the end of the game, other than in a non-player character being alive or in a better or worse situation. What I would love to see happen is games getting to a point where the story has become profoundly different and you're miles away from what the character you would have been and the outcome that would have happened had you gone down a different path. I know we're going to get there, but I'm not taking anything away from the games that I'm describing, like the Telltale stuff, but at the same time it's like, okay, what's really changed?
Right.
I mean, the journey's still good, the writing's still good, but there's just that extra little oomph that I'm really hoping to see happen.
Yeah, absolutely. See if I have any more. The only other commodity confession I have is health insurance. Because that's what Tracy and I are going to be spending our money on once the Affordable Care Act gets totally fucked.
We have two more months of comfort.
Well, here's my plan, Aaron. I think when that goes out the window, I feel like all of my friends who are on marketplace stuff, what we need to do is we need to just take over a hospital. Yeah. we need to just be able to blackmail a hospital administrator.
Here's what I'm really hoping happens. All right, the Affordable Care Act has been in place for a significant amount of time.
Hmm.
International markets have adjusted and been born and risen and fallen because of this.
Right.
Whether any president who wanted to mess with it is going to have to not just compete with our national government, but international governments. And I'm really hoping that the pressure, those pressures will hopefully slow the speed of anything being undone.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us for this podcast.
Yeah. Hopefully tune in next month when things are hopefully a little bit more positive.
We'll make this shit with tin cans and string if we have to.
Yeah.
In the words of Neil Gaiman in The Sandman, we have heard the languages of apocalypse and we shall now embrace the silence. Good night, Joel.
Good night.
Thus concludes episode 17 of Gateway Geeks, The End. Embrace the silence. This caps out season 1 of the podcast. Stay tuned for the launch of season 2 with new surprises in store. If you like this, hit us up on Twitter at GatewayGeeksSTL, on Facebook, or email us at contact@gatewaygeeks.com. As always, you can find us on St. Louis Vernacular website at stlouisvernacular.com. Until next time, stay frosty, kiddos, but, you know, not nuclear. Take care of yourselves. We love you. It's not okay, but it's going to be.